before we jump into our conversation, we wanted to remind you all about some very exciting news about the Austin Film Festival this year. In addition to being there in person and doing our live story panel, in addition to some other panels, we're going to be throwing a party, a TSL party in partnership with Final Draft.
And we are really excited to have our partners in Final Draft. I mean, not other than it, you know, it is the industry standard. You all need to know it. But they're just such a great, great company to work with. And the party is going to be on Saturday, October 28th, right after our story workshop at Stephen F's Bar and Terrace.
So come and meet us and maybe even get some swag.
Oh, some swag, some TSL swag, some Final Draft swag. Yes. I would like some Final Draft swag. Come, you guys. Okay, let's get into it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to The Screenwriting Life. I'm Meg LaFoe.
And I'm Lorianne McKenna. And today we are at Stevens College and we're doing a live podcast where we're gonna do a story workshop. So the first person up who's gonna do it with us is Rex Obana. So Rex, this is where you tell us your story and we're gonna ask you questions.
I just have to correct you.
How do you pronounce your name?
Obano.
Obano, what'd I say?
You said the former president of the United States.
Obama? Did I say Obama?
Well, kind of, yeah.
Obana. Oh, I said Obana.
Yes, Obana.
Rex, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Yes, so the television drama is about a missing persons unit, and there are two cops. You say cops over here, we say policemen, but, you know, okay. When in Rome. The first policeman is Sally Mountie. She has given her best years to the police force, she's good at finding missing persons, very, very good. The saying is, Mountie gets her man.
Nice.
Yeah, so the thing is, because she's given her best life to the police force, she hasn't had a child. She hasn't managed to have a child, and that's what she wants. And so she's going through IVF. We call it IVF, do you call it over here? Uh-huh. And the series, in a sense, as she's looking for the missing children, she is trying to search, find her own. And it's tearing her apart because it's not going very well. So she's kind of torn between her kind of allegiances to other mothers and parents and her desire to be one. The other cop is so new, I can call him Tyrone. He hasn't got a surname or any kind of moniker. And he's another cop, and he's very, very good, again, at searching for missing children or missing people. But his children, he has three, have been taken away in a bitter custody battle. So then again, with him, he is trying to, his allegiance of searching for other people's children and then kind of having a battle for his own. And these two cops have given their life to searching for the children, but they are being torn apart inside. So every week there's a story of the week, there's a missing child, there's a missing person. I haven't gone through, you know, the story of the week element of it. But it is about these two people, and it's about my brother's son was taken into care when he was 6 to about 16. And I saw my brother kind of disintegrate mentally with that trauma, court cases, social services, as we call them. And so this is kind of, in a sense, my way of homaging that period in my family's life. And that's what I've got so far, literally. These are the notes.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, it's so powerful, and I know we're not supposed to be talking about how to pitch, but I can't help it. It's so powerful to hear the personal and, you know, why you, that question, why are you the person to write this? Can you see how it all comes alive when people talk with their personal connection to a story? I thought that was very powerful and told very well, mm-hmm. considering you came up with it in the cab.
Yes.
I have to say,
yes.
You're a great storyteller. And I'm very interested in it. I have some questions, but I want to let you say what you liked first.
I agree too, because I'm like, well, does he have kids? What's happening? And then when you tell the story about your brother and the pain you saw, the pain you had around it too, it did really bring it together. And it was like, oh yes, this is a story you can tell with your lava, right? I have questions too. My first question though is, and you might not know this, right? Because you just came up with it, but what is the conflict between those two main characters? Because they're on a similar journey, right? Both are sort of looking, one to find her own child and one to get his children back. So what's the conflict? Are they partners?
Yes, they are partners. They work in the same missing persons
department. So what's, how are they grinding together? Like, why am I going to watch this show in terms of the characters, right? When you think of a show like SVU, it's how those characters are navigating and negotiating the relationship to the crime, but also to each other.
Okay. I don't know that. something that I was thinking, I was working on another show and something thinking about, in a sense, what the conflict is between them, but not great enough that they're arguing all the time.
Yes,
they're fighting
right.
All the
no,
time.
I don't want that.
It might be a difference of approach. It might be, I don't want to have a love interest between them. I don't want to have any, that they're married or related, but there's got to be something. It might be that one is old and one is young. I'm not 100% sure. It might be that, but yeah.
Yeah, approach, like it could be, you know, is it Scully and
Mulder?
Right? Yeah. They just have different views of the world, so their beliefs are so different. Even though they have the same goal, those beliefs will keep banging. Or I was thinking, you know, let's just talk about, like, one could be ready to retire, Lethal Weapon, one's ready to retire, and one is young and foolhardy and constantly putting them in danger. Yeah.
I'm too old for this,
right? You know, I'm just thinking about the archetypes of pairs, right? But they're cops, so they're each, you know, actors love to play skills, right? So they might have different skills that are complementary, but also clash, right? Because in order to do his thing, he has to be improv'd all the time, and she wants to go by the book.
Like, can one be psychic?
One could be psychic.
Yeah.
I think that was a TV show, right? But you can see when you think about the TV shows with cops, why they're doing that is to start to give the relationship narrative drive.
I like Cagney and Lacey. I do like that.
That's another
balance,
one.
You know, where I'm not sure which one it was. I think it was Cagney. She could never settle down, whereas Lacey had Harve, and they were just, you know, she had that family dynamic going, and you had the clash between both of them. So yeah,
because we want it. We know at the end of the day, I mean, not so much anymore, but it used to be that they are going to get their man, right? So it's the how they get them, and the how is very much about the emotional relationship between the two of them. And it's great what you're doing, that your brain is thinking of other Cagney and Lacey. Like, when I create, I always try to think of, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I don't copy, but it's kind of like, you know, painters would first, in the Renaissance, would first study the masters. And then they would go and find their own voice.
And copy. You see that in museums, right?
But then they would find their own voice once they got their skill set down. So sometimes if I'm given, like, I'm right now writing a horror movie, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to watch a million horror movies, right? And figure out the math that other people have done. I can break it, but I have to know I'm breaking it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I guess my other question, other than the relationship, which is also often why you really tune in, because you love them together, right?
Yeah.
Is the world. So is the world of the show going to be mostly the investigation? Are we also going to be going home with them?
Yes, I think with Sally, it's the home is quite alone and stark. You know, she's a single person. She work her life is her work, or has been. And also, I think with Tyrone, the same thing as well. I mean, I'm not sure. Sometimes when I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and when she goes away on camp or something, the house is very different.
It
feels very different. And I think the office, the precinct, is alive with people. And they go to homes which are alive with people to a certain degree. But theirs is quite stark. But I do want, I think you said something about tone earlier.
Tone.
And I do want it to be kind of hopeful. I don't want it to be kind of, you know, I would say torture porn, but just kind of, you know, down every week. I do want, maybe if they're not found, they don't always have to be found, but they do find something to a certain degree. So I do want it kind of to be hopeful and up. I mean, I think series is like The Practice. I like The Practice, the law series a couple of years ago. Younger people might not remember it. But yes, which was, in a sense, very, very hopeful at the end, but not, in a sense, like Ally McBeal hopeful, which was kind of, you know, a pastiche. But yeah, just very hopeful. So it's
If I'm an executive, I'm going to think, wow, that's all a bummer.
Yeah.
Like, missing kids, you lost your kids, you can't get pregnant. Like, what's fun here? Tell me what's fun here, right? So in terms of just thinking of the show, and I know you're just starting, so this is, I'm just thinking, I'm just throwing out ideas, like, do you need to code one of them up? So she seems to have a great life. Yeah. She doesn't want kids. She's perfectly happy. Mm-hmm. She's like this fun character. You can't wait to see her.
Yeah.
But she does have a secret.
Yes.
Which is, you know what I mean? And I'm not saying you're not saying this. Yeah. I'm just trying to say, I want to go see her have fun and have a great life. And she doesn't need to have a husband. She's perfectly happy not having a husband. I don't know. This is a personal thing that this is a personal thing. So take it or leave it.
Yeah, what I was looking for is a single woman, great life. Secretly, she's doing IVF, and that there's a waiting and a hope and a loss in that. Mm-hmm. You know, fertility stuff is really hard, and you keep it secret a lot of the times because there's shame in it, right? But it's a secret thing. So out here, you're like, oh, no, I'm fine, I'm great. But then there's this bucket of hope and grief and loss at home. And I kind of wanted him to be, this is my take, because, and it's easy for me to do this because you're still forming the idea. So take this as just like what my point of view as somebody who went through fertility, as somebody whose life changed unexpectedly with a kid, like that he would have a family and it would seem happy and fine, and but that under it is this, that there's something really like a divorce, or she's trying to take the kids and he's struggling to hold on to it in that same way. And so that there is a, because when you have kids, let's be honest, there is that point of, would I do this again? I love my daughter. She absolutely should be in the world. But there is grief around having kids because your old life is gone. And just that, so not that it's about being a parent, but it feels like there's a big piece of this. And it's such a identity changing thing, so that it's not all, not all sadness, but you do get different windows into what it looks like, and losing kids, losing the hope for kids, you know, all that kind of, it goes to theme, right?
Yeah.
And you know, again, this is just more my personal thing. Women always have to want a kid. Mm-hmm. So I'm just want to throw that out there for something you to consider as a female character. I'd be interested in a woman who is perfectly happy not having kids, mm-hmm. and that she is mothering all these lost girls and boys. Those are her children, right? And yet there's still a question of she's alone, right? That there's a sense then that she's protecting herself from actually true emotional intimacy, mm-hmm. which then could come into the partnership. So it's just kind of digging in, which I'm sure you will. You thought about it 2 seconds ago. You know, and
three seconds ago,
just digging into those layers of the characters, which you will, and thematically is, and again, it's new. Do you have any sense of thematically what you want the show to be, you know, kind of running on? Is it, I don't think it's parenting necessarily. Is there any word that comes to mind?
The only word specifically is loss.
Right.
However that means to each character.
Right.
And how that is manifested through action and through need and through desire.
Loss is a great word. And what's great about it is their job is to refuse that loss. Mm. Their job is to fix that loss, regain, right?
Yeah.
And how are they doing that in their own personal lives or not, right? Are they getting overwhelmed by it or not? So I think that would be powerful mm-hmm. stuff. That would be powerful stuff.
But then in loss too, there's the parents, you're showing that, like, everybody deals with that differently, mm-hmm. right? Some people look guilty because they've shut it down. And then you can have the hope part, mm-hmm. you know, where everybody, when they find the lost little boy, mm-hmm. everybody has that sense of hope. But then there's the next one.
Yeah.
And what's great about your show too, in terms of usually when people pitch TV shows, we spend most of our time talking about the engine, mm-hmm. but because it's a procedural, they just immediately have an engine.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about that. There has to be an engine to the relationship, right? Which is why they're going to pitch to you. Can they be in love? Yeah. Because that's an easy engine like that.
So if you're very clear up front, no. I mean, in terms of these are their relationships, this is their belief system, their point of view.
And how they're helping each other through loss, and is what's evolving in the relationship, the emotional intimacy of being honest with each other about stuff versus you know, not.
Yeah.
Right? So that something is evolving.
I mean, that's really interesting because, you know, how honest are they being to each other?
Right.
When they have to be honest as they're working together to solve the case. How honest are they or the case is, how honest are they being as people, as well as how honest are they being as policemen? Because, you know.
Right, because the whole first season could be about them starting to be honest with each other and forming a relationship so that I'm loving watching them come together and, oh, I know she didn't tell her that. Yeah. Oh, boy. Mm. You know, but she didn't tell him that, you know, and so that you're watching them. And then the second season, because they will, you know, want to know, then this, if they've come together and we love them as a team, then the second season, what's happening to that team, right? And in the third season, what's happening to that team? And you have to have at least three seasons to tell me about the relationship and how it's moving. And listen, procedurals, people want to tune in to see what they want to see. They want to see the same thing over and over.
Right, yeah.
So there is a network version of the show where they're really not changing and that they are exactly the two people that they are every week. I, because I come from features, tend to like the shows that evolve over the course of the season. So, you know, that's a choice that you need to make right away. Is this a network show that is a procedural? And what I'm tuning in for is that this team will always be this team. And I know how she's going to react, and I know how he's going to react, and it's juicy, and I love it. Like Cagney and Lacey.
Yeah.
Even though there's some evolution, of course, but really, Cagney's Cagney and Lacey's Lacey, and forever that will be what it is. Or is it more of a streamer where you're giving them a procedural, which they would love, by the way, but there's this evolving storylines over the season arcs too, and then you pitch them at least three, right? And for the networks, they want, you know, 100 episodes, so that's why it can always be the same, and it can be interchangeable and all that stuff that was talked about in the other keynote.
And for the pilot, it's important to start in the action. Right? Like, I'm going to read your pilot. I want to know that it's a procedural, right? We could spend a lot of time with exposition and introductions, but I want to see that exposition in how they're solving the case and the things they're telling each other and not telling each other. And then, you know, like Nurse Jackie. Remember Nurse Jackie, the pilot for Nurse Jackie?
I think I was a bit too young for that, but...
It just came out. How dare you?
That sounded funny in my head to be here.
It was funny. I thought it was a stir.
Cagney and Lacey want to talk about chips or Petticoat Junction or something. Good grief. Nurse Jackie came out like last year. Fine, we're not going to talk about it. Keep going.
Petticoat Junction.
That
oh
is
my gosh.
You know Petticoat Junction? Then let's talk about high school.
You did awesome. Thank you so much for being our friend.
Thank you. Do you want to pick the next one?
Thank you.
Good luck.
Awesome. No, you pick. You're the picker.
All right, you guys. Who's sending me the strongest vibe? Chris Brown? He's shaking his head. Did I pronounce that one right?
Yes.
You guys are not exactly have the best penmanship. This is a note to everyone. Does that say Brown? It's like...
It does kind of say Brown.
Unfortunately, it says Brown.
Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Hi,
good
welcome.
Good morning.
Yeah, hello. Good morning.
I know, you're a bit on the spot. It's all good. Take a breath. Feel your feet.
Do that too. Okay.
Okay. So the project I'm working on currently is a feature film. It's called Kindred at the moment, working title. So it's actually very Pixar-ish, inspired by a certain movie about feelings that I love.
Is it an animated movie or no?
It is an animated
movie. Okay, yes, animated movie,
yep.
Kindred, got it.
Kindred. You basically start in the world, human world. This character named Zora, she's a photojournalist. She is trying to get this picture of the shady deal going on. And you realize you kind of move into this other world and you notice it's about this like kind of reckless dog spirit is kind of like navigating her or managing her movements. What she does, it's pushing her to do certain things. And she's working with the teammate, this kind of jaded dog, this other coyote. And they're not gelling at all. They're just not doing well. And come to find out, these are like spirit animals, and they mine human interaction in order to sustain their world.
Sustain the human world, or
sustain their spirit world.
Their spirit world.
Yes.
Okay.
So like Monsters, Inc.
It's kind of a symbiotic relationship. So humans get, you know, you get the liveliness, you get the energy that you need to move on, to push yourself, but you're also sustaining the astral world. And so they basically the coyote spirit quits because another spirit can't work with Kendra. She's dog spirit. Her name is Kendra Barkley. Kendra Barkley. She's going through a few partners at this point, and this is her last chance. Basically, she gets paired up. Usually, they work with animals kind of near who they are, but she's kind of going through most of the dog spirits. So now she has to be forced to work with Gale, Headwind, and Eagle. And he is kind of rigid, kind of Kendra's not really about the rules. She's more about guidelines. And Gale is more like, no, we're going to do this the right way. And they clash, but come to find out that, like, he's got a past that he's holding on to that keeps him from, you know, really being mm-hmm. himself. And Kendra's dealing with Zora, and Zora's having a hard time. She's great at work, but her home life is kind of suffering because of it. And so you see the interactions between these worlds and between Zora and Gale as they get on the trail of kind of a conspiracy in her world that is kind of damaging the human world and the astral world. So reluctantly, Gale and Zora team up, or Gale and Kendra team up in order to save both worlds.
And can Zora doesn't know they're there? Kind of like Inside Out, Riley doesn't know?
No idea. This spirit world really pushes on the human world without the interaction, without anybody knowing about what's going on.
So does the main action, great job.
Thank you.
So the main action is in the spirit world. So
Correct.
The main character is
Kendra.
Miss Barkley.
Yes, Miss Barkley.
Kendra Barkley. And so we're going to see how their guidance of the human mm-hmm. sort of affects her, and then as they're uncovering this. So act two is them on the journey of uncovering this thing while also trying to help her get through whatever she's trying to get through.
Because all Kendra wants is to pilot Zora by herself, like the old days. Each spirit animal was...
Oh, so there's a paradigm shift here. You have to have a partner now.
You have to have a partner because in the old days, people were always thriving and connecting, and it was easier
listening to their guardian dogs.
Since technology has arrived, people have gotten more complacent. It's harder to mine spirit energy from humans. So,
because they don't have anything anymore.
Exactly.
Okay.
The Spirit Regulation Agency. We need a compliance. So
is it like Monsters Inc. where they're getting energy for their world from humans?
Yes, it's
and then
very
what do
similar.
They give back to humans? What do humans get that they
humans
need?
Get
that kind of alive presentness?
Yeah, it's called I call it inspiration. So whenever when man discovered fire.
Right. So it's like muses. They're almost like muses.
Yes, exactly.
So I'd be on my phone scrolling, and I'd get an idea, and my guardian would say, hey, go write that idea down. But I'd be like, or I can just sit here and keep scrolling.
Exactly. Okay. That would diminish
the world. And then if you do go write it down, what does the spirit world get? Is it a visual? Like, look what in Monsters, Inc., they made the canisters, right? So that it was very tactile.
I will admit there are some similarities.
That's okay.
No,
that's every story in the world.
It's called a spirit meter, spirit energy, whatever it's called.
That's great.
But it's made to, but it also sustains all of their world. It like gives them food, it gives them water, it sustains their entire world. Because the thing that connects the human world and the spirit world is something called, it's a giant structure called a tether. And it connects the two worlds.
Okay. So the worst thing that could happen is they would break apart.
The tether would break.
Okay.
And I'm assuming then in Act Two, that is the threat, that the tether is going to break.
That is part of it, yes. But there is let me get a little deeper into this because there's a lot of lore to this. Kendra, they work for a company called Kindred. Uh-huh. They mind spirit energy. And they're being taken over by kind of the Amazon of their world. There, it's a merger called Spira, and this beautiful butterfly man is in charge of it. He's taking over the you know, helping the world, and he's like, we're going to help the merger, and we're going to make Kindred better than ever, and we're going to save our world. And that's pretty much what it boils down to. But they're like, Gale used to be a guardian. He used to be kind of a cop, and something happened, and he was sent to Kindred to work there. So you kind of uncover some of their past and stuff that's happening there. So,
okay, I'm going to ask you a question. So when I'm seeing this movie, imagine it. The movie is up at, you know, Hollywood. What's the big theater on Hollywood Boulevard?
El Cap.
Yeah, it's at the El Cap.
Okay.
Packed audience. You've got the dancers. The whole thing is happening, right? The whole production.
Okay.
At the end of the movie, what do you want me to feel?
Feel. I want you to feel connected, because the theme of my film is connection. Like, in order for humanity to thrive, we need to be
connected to what?
Each other. I see what you're saying here, but
so at the end of Inside Out, why we're so moved by it is because we're not even allowed to feel sad, we're encouraged to feel sad.
Yeah,
being sad is healthy. And this sort of unlocked in all of us this, like, oh my God, I'm not bad or weak or some terrible pejorative thing for feeling sadness. It's healthy. So at the end of Monsters, Inc., right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what do you want me to feel personally? So connection is great.
Okay.
But connected to what? Myself? My muse? Giving myself permission? Not only do I have permission to write it, I have a responsibility. I have, like, what it.
Yes, I think it's, I can't remember which love it is. It's not agape. It's one of the Greek ones. I think it's for mankind, humanity. It's that love, in which, in order for us to succeed, we have to be connected. I don't know exactly how to.
People have to be connected, or we have to be connected to the spirit world.
No, yes, we have to be the spirit world, but the thing that makes the spirit world go, what they encourage, is us to, you know, be our best, to thrive, to do that, to do what we can to get there. And I think part of that is, so many people think, like Elon Musk, he believes that the only way to get forward is somebody has to be the smartest person and somebody has to build something for that. And it's like, that's not necessarily it. What we need to do is work together and make more farmland. We need to work together in order to make the
world. So it's connection to each other.
Yes.
So we see the human character. Sorry, then I'll let you go. I just keep interrupting Meg. She's being very gracious. So the human character, what is she going through? She's not connected, she's distant, and then at the end she becomes connected to the bigger world?
Yes, but her journey is she's trying to catch this shady deal so that this peace deal can go through, this peace deal for the city so they could get a better I think it's a green deal is what I put in the story, because I've already written a full draft. But what she's lost, because Kendra's pushing her so hard, is connection with her family. She's getting divorced, she's losing her kid, and she forgot the reason she was doing all of this. She lost that connection to her family because she was going so hard to paint, because Kendra couldn't see what's good for Kendra. Yeah, it's to be good at her job for her daughter, but what's more than that is she needs to be there for her daughter, because that's why she was doing this in the first place.
What is her action in the climax of the movie? The main character, who is the
Kindred?
Kindred, yeah. What's her action in the climax of the movie?
In the climax of the movie, her action is she finally starts to begin to trust Gale, and they work together. Like, because she's
so trust.
She's
going to trust Gale, and they're going to work together.
Yes.
What's her end of Act Two?
Her end of Act Two. What happens at the end of Act Two? At the end of Act Two, they. Can't remember.
It's okay.
I know.
So just something to think about.
Go for it.
And it's all really interesting. So
okay.
My brain is just, these aren't comments or even criticism. It's like, A, I'm trying to understand to make sure, because I haven't read a script. And B, just to, because I've been where you are right now, which is a lot of stuff. And Pete Docter loves a lot of stuff. And, you know, like, but part of the job, as you know, as you start to write drafts, is starting to pare it down and get really focused. And what do you need? And what is the story, right? Of all this beautiful stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the word connection is such a big word,
true,
right?
True.
And it's a great word, and especially if, I don't know what draft you're on, but if you're in early drafts, that's a great, you know, at Pixar or even at Disney Animation, you would just put the word on the wall.
Okay.
Because so that everybody knows we're somewhere in the bucket of connection, right? But it's not yet a theme yet because that's a big word.
Right.
It's what you're saying about connection,
mm-hmm.
The how of it,
gotcha.
Or, I mean, there's a million movies inside of connection. So sure. What I immediately go to is, okay, whatever she's doing at the, whatever she realizes at the end of Act Two
mm-hmm.
is your thematic.
Okay.
So whatever your main character kind of comes to realize about herself,
mm-hmm.
please make it about herself and not just about other people, especially if it's a female character.
Right.
She has to be the main character, which means she has to realize it about herself, the blindness, unless she's a claiming character, like mm-hmm. Moana, and we can talk about that. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds like she needs to really learn to trust and become emotionally intimate so that she can have a partner. So she does sound like a transformative character. So whatever she realizes about herself and therefore the world
mm-hmm.
and where she's gone off track is your emotional thematic. So
okay.
if it is about ultimately trusting her partner,
mm-hmm.
then your movie is about the bucket of trust.
Okay.
I'm not saying you can't have a movie with trust and connection. You can,
mm-hmm.
but at some point you also have to pick a pony so that you can go deeper
mm-hmm.
into that context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because if it's about trust, I want to know about what, and this is where the lava starts to come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you personally interested in, afraid of, blind about trust? Where do you have problems trusting? Because her journey right now does seem more to be about, I don't want to work with anybody else. I'm perfectly good by myself. I don't,
mm-hmm.
why? Because I have a wound. I don't trust people because they've always, always, always betray you, whatever. That's the easiest version. But
to that point, there is a backstory for her as well. She doesn't like Gale at first because basically you sense that she doesn't like Guardians. She doesn't like the cops. But you realize that she lost both her. One of the things she says in the movie is that Guardians always do things for others, but never do anything for themselves. And that's a thing she basically says. And you find out that she lost both of her parents, that they were both guardians, and they went out on a job and didn't come back, and she was like, but
what would happen to a guardian that they wouldn't come back?
They have similar bodies in their world to us,
uh-huh.
so they can die, but
were they killed by a bad guy who we're going to see in Act Two? So this is, again,
okay.
I'm just digging around with you. So if you have a backstory that's super important like that,
mm-hmm.
then Act Two better be about it. So that's something to be careful of.
Okay.
I'm not saying you are into it. You have a lot of ideas,
mm-hmm.
and I, and again, it's a pitch, so maybe
yep.
it's hard.
Yep.
But I just want to warn you, having been where you are,
mm-hmm.
that because in Inside Out, we have three worlds going, right? We have Riley, we have the headquarters, and we have down below,
yeah,
right?
Down below, yeah.
So the trick of that movie is they constantly have to be affecting each other.
Right.
Because if they're not and they're just paralleling, out that scene goes.
Right.
Like literally anything that happens down here affects headquarters, affects Riley, and Riley now affects, and it's rippling back and forth when you have all these different worlds going,
right?
So they thematically all are traveling on the same line. Because if they're thematically even degrees off, you're going to get confusion and mud,
right?
Not clarity, right? Because everybody, Riley, headquarters, and Joy and Sadness, and Bing Bong, are all really digging into the same thematic.
Okay.
So just be careful about that, meaning trust versus connection versus blah, blah, blah. And then world rules, it's hard on a pitch. You know, you got to be super clear, and you will be, I'm sure, on the rules of what are the stakes of Guardians. I can't visually see it yet either.
Okay.
Like, and like on Inside Out, he's probably, and I wasn't there, you were, might have been there, like, they're drawing immediately
mm-hmm.
to try to, did he have drawings and paintings immediately to show the mind?
Yeah, the art department started almost immediately. Ralph Eggleston, who was the production designer, was already doing big concept pieces.
Because he's got to explain to the powers that be, this is the world, this is what the mind looks like, it's such a big part of it.
And it helps, like when you have the big art, like even just a sketch of what headquarters might look like or what the world looks like with the lands,
right?
It felt like, oh, okay, we go from here to here. It helps visually.
Help. So if you were to even give the script, you're probably also going to give some artwork so they can immediately see. And you might know that. But and then the other thing I wanted to say before I lose you is, what was I going to say? Because now I'm thinking about artwork.
I have one thing, which is I think there's a lot of things going on, right? All great stuff, and it's about narrowing it down. So like at the beginning of Act One, what is Kendra's belief system? Something Meg talks about, right? Like, is it I'm responsible for my parents' death and that's why I don't want to have a partner because I think I'm going to put you in jeopardy and kill you? So then I'm going to just, and that's what we, that's the belief
person,
system.
Who, often when movies are about trust, the person that, who is the person that you, that person doesn't trust? Themselves. So it, if you externalize that into, I actually might have killed my parents, that I understand now suddenly why trust is in the plot of the movie.
Yeah, no, that's always good. Or is it something else, right? Sort of that belief system is what, even what Jeff Melvoin was talking about, you know, the belief system, it's the same thing we are talking about, right? Belief system, it gets threatened and then a new belief system.
And then how that she, and sometimes it's easier to think about the story really just from your main character's point of view, in terms of, I'm going to introduce you to this thing, it's called a ghost spirit, and it looks like this, and these are the rules, and this is what happened to her, and what nobody knows is this is what happened, and I'm meeting the human through her, right? So that it's not too bifurcated. I guess my last question for you, if I hope any of this has been helpful, is why is it personal to you?
It's personal to me because I was actually talking to some people about this yesterday. I have a problem with people I think don't always reach their maximum potential, and I think that's because so many people believe that their maximum potential is focusing on something independent as opposed to, you know, I think humanity, a lot of humanity believe that if I'm the best I can be, me personally, I can achieve something. And it's like, technically that's true, but if you're not trying to achieve something for the greater good or with the greater good, I don't think that matters at the end of the day.
And how is that personal to you?
Personal to me? Because it's, for me, I think writing for me personally is that greater good. And I think that like media is, we don't talk to each other through books. We don't talk to each other through a lot of certain things. We talk to each other through movies and TV shows.
Okay, what's so interesting to me, and we don't have to put this in the podcast, is that I want to put you on the spot. You're staying in your intellect pretty hardcore,
right?
Which means there's a lot of lava down there.
Yeah.
Because your brain, and it's fair, we're in front of audience, it's a podcast. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you to go beyond your intellect, but your intellect is protecting you right now, and it's very smart. And really interesting. So I'm not even commenting on what you're saying, but you're still not telling me how it's personal to you.
So there's think, know, and feel. And you're talking about what you think. Mm-hmm. And then there's know. I know what kind of shoes I'm wearing. Right. I know what I'm gonna, what I ate for breakfast. Then there's feel.
Mm-hmm. Then the answer is I don't know.
Okay.
What it boils down to.
No, and you don't have to know right now. But I'll just tell you that a lot of the work at Pixar is hours and hours and hours of answering that personal question.
Gotcha.
And we all have to bring it every day. You can feel very naked at Pixar every party because you're constantly having to bring that to the table every day. So, and what I just want to show to you and for your next draft or what you're thinking about as you get notes or whatever's going to happen is the rudder is going to be allowing that to come up into the center of the story. The theme is emotional, it's not intellectual.
Right.
The theme is going to be something that is your lava, is, you know, makes you feel vulnerable. And then once you start to get that in your hands, right, that becomes the rudder for all the other choices of all that other great stuff you have.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you said to me, I'm making this up, you know, I had my brother was my very best friend in the whole world, and he betrayed me. And to get back at him, I did this horrible thing, and I ruined his life. And so I want to talk about trust and my own power that I'm really afraid to unleash because the one time I unleashed it, it was in revenge. And look what it did. And so suddenly I'm understanding, oh, yeah, I get what you want to talk about. Okay, let's get in and pick some story stuff, right? Because now the story is going to be driven by this heat, right? And I know what to help you pick. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't know what to help you pick. Everything is interesting. It's all intellectually cool. But I have to pick mm-hmm. based on that heat. So like Pete Docter literally, he would make us go on walks. And he would go on long, long walks because he intuitively is a genius at staying connected to that, right? Mm. And he was not going deep enough. He knew when he started he wanted to talk about what happened to his girl, little girl when she was 11, because before she turned 11, she was like, she would meet people at the front door and be like, hello, I'm going to do a tap dance for you because I'm fabulous. And she was very happy. And then at 11, she got very into herself and he said, I lost my little girl's joy and I want to find out where she went. Mm-hmm. Okay? And we're not at a story yet. Mm-hmm. We're at a situation. Right? But he's got a personal question that he's driving towards. What happened? What this emotion can be about can be a question you have based on something that happened in your life. And that question starts to rudder the whole thing. Do you see what I'm saying? He's saying, what happened to my little girl's joy? Mm-hmm. But see, the problem with that doesn't drive a story yet because it's still outside of him. Okay. Like, for the first pitch, be careful because the emotional thematic happened to your brother, not you. Mm-hmm. So it's going to echo out and not have the power of something that you experience. I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm just saying that's going to be, you've got to still put you inside of it. So as he's developing it, he decides, well, you know, when I was in middle school, I was a really scared kid. So it must be with fear. But he would get back joy, and he knew he wanted joy to get lost in the mind and then come back. And who is she with? What's the main relationship? It's going to be fear. But he said every time they came back, he didn't have anything to say about fear. Mm-hmm. He just emotionally didn't have an insight or some experience or something of what he wants to say to the world about fear. Mm. And so he was realizing when I came on, he was just starting to realize, I think it might be sadness. And in the original DVD release, I wish Disney Plus, if you're listening, would put this on Disney Plus, because it's so amazing. He takes a camera and he's walking in the woods up in San Francisco and he's talking to himself. And he's literally saying, I think this movie is going to get shut down. Imagine that, multiple Academy Awards. So just know your imposter syndrome, your doubt about your story, that is part of the creative process. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're not a writer. It doesn't mean it's not good. It means you're right on track. Pete Docter is walking in the woods saying, my movie's going to get shut down. I don't know what my movie is. People are walking out of the theater and they're saying it's a good idea. And by now they should be saying it's a movie. And he can't figure it out. He's got too many pieces, right? And so he's walking and talking. He's like, and this is what he does, which is amazing and why he's who he is. He doesn't move away into his intellect when he hits that fear of my movie shutting down. He moves down into it. So you can watch him walk and go, okay, so, what's gonna happen when they shut my movie down? Well, I'm gonna first lose my house because I'll get fired. And that would be bad to lose my house. Wow, is that really what I'm the most afraid of? And he's like, no, I think the worst part would be I couldn't come to Pixar every day. Okay, if I can't come to Pixar, do you see how he's going deeper and deeper? If I can't come to Pixar every day, why is that bad? Why does that make me feel? Well, I'm going to really miss the people. It's not the place, it's the people. Okay, why am I going to miss the people? I'm going to miss the people because of all the fun times we've had. You know, we've had so much fun.
Oh, no, you're making me sad about leaving Pixar.
So he's like, but look, he's going to go down one more because he's not there yet, right? He doesn't feel vulnerable yet. He doesn't feel that lava coming up. He's coming up. You can see it on his face. It's starting to come up. And he goes, okay, I'm going to miss all the happy people. I'm going to miss. But you know what what I'm going to really miss is all the hard times we've had. And how that has bonded us, because they lost Joe Ranft, which was an original founder of Pixar, in a car accident, and they lost Steve Jobs, and many other things. But those losses bound them together in a deep way of connection. And that connection of having lost together mm-hmm. and suffered together is what he would miss, that emotional intimacy. And suddenly he goes, oh, it's sadness. And you can watch him go down, 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 right? So now we have a rudder. Mm. Now, I mean, there's all kinds of challenges to what he wants to do, but now I know as a writer, I can absolutely, like, so for the first thing is, well, then sadness has to be on the journey. You don't even have her on the journey. Like, all kinds of stuff. We can start to really roll because we have this emotional rudder about sadness. And the first thing I say to him is, you know, that means we have to cry at the end of this movie. Is John Lasseter going to let us? We cry because if the thematic is accept sadness, mm-hmm. you're going to have to do it in the movie. And what's really interesting, just as a side point, so often, the very thing you're asking the audience to, the character to do in your script, you are not doing. Because it's not an emotional thing you have yet processed fully. So you're not doing it in the script, and you're doing the opposite to your character. It would be like, okay, we're gonna put sadness in the dump and have Joy go find her. Well, are we asking Joy to confront her own sadness? No, we're protecting her from the very theme that we're trying to do. It's just, it's a really interesting thing that the brain does. That is not what you're doing, because I don't know your story well enough. But so that rudder, you don't have to do it right now with us, but it's something, that would be the next thing if I was working with you. I would say, do not pass go, do not go anywhere else until you start digging down. You can look at the end of Act Two for this. That's where it should be coming up, that subtext, that love is coming up into context. You can look at your favorite scenes and why you love them. You can look at the scenes that you cannot get right and why can't you get them right? Because the lava might be sitting right under there and your brain is like, don't look over there. Just don't even look over there. It might be a flat character often. It's weird. The brain will flatten out a character because it's very afraid of what's underneath there. So I would do some exercises, not to promote Lorien, but she does do these exercises with people to pull their lava up. I would start to do that to get into something that really makes you shake a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I would then start to build around that.
Okay.
But take it or leave it. Take it or leave it.
I want to say I love your concept. I love your concept. It's wish fulfillment. Yeah. I wish I had dogs or animals, like, you know, a guardian angel, like, helping me, inspiring me. Like,
yeah,
that feels
really
very
fun.
Comforting. And I love the idea of a spirit world and they're paying attention that we fuel each other mm-hmm. and that there is that symbiotic relationship, which is what you're talking about in terms of connection, mm-hmm. right? If yeah. one of us falls down, we all fall down, right? Mm-hmm. But I really love the concept.
Okay.
So Meg just talked a lot about of all the ways you're gonna be like, oh my God, I don't have anything. What do I have and how do I fix this? But I think the concept is really good. And mm-hmm. if I saw this in a trailer, I'd be like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah.
Brandon,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you.
Hi.
My story is a comedy heist feature film. It's called Waiting for Robbo. So it's an Australian film. And it's about, it kicks off with two members of a kind of dysfunctional gang who are waiting in their car at a deserted beach for the other two members of the gang to turn up after a heist where they've inserted themselves between a gang of female bikies and a strange branch of the Finnish mafia who are operating in regional Australia, as they do. So the two main characters are Cole and Eric, and they're waiting for Robbo and Fat Boy. Fat Boy is a young, thin girl, actually, they're the other two members of the gang. And as they're waiting, they start going over the heist in their mind, replaying what actually happened, and they realise that they have different versions and things didn't go according to plan. And as time ticks by, they realize that Robbo is not coming. They decide that Robbo has, you know, tricked them all. Then they find out they've got, Robbo gave them backup plans, like an envelope with open this at 3 o'clock if everything else goes wrong. They both open these backup plans, which say that they should shoot each other and burn the car. And, you know, in the meantime, they discover that Fat Boy is actually in the dunes with a high-powered rifle, taking pot shots at them. They finally open the boot of the car, which is where the jewels are meant to be. The MacGuffin of the story, and they find in the boot of the car is Robbo. who's been bound and gagged. And is that enough to kick off?
What's Act Two? So we've got the movie is the Yellow Brick Road, right? Yep. So what's your Yellow Brick Road?
So none of them really seem to know what happened to the jewels. The end of Act Two is that the bikies and the Finnish mafia turn up to get revenge on the gang because they don't know where the stuff is either, and there's a massive shootout which leaves Robbo dead, the gang are happy that the Robbo's been killed. They find on him what they think are the jewels, but are actually another set of fakes. Everybody leaves, leaving the two main characters, Eric and Cole, back where they started. Then they finally work out where the real stuff is, but it's been accidentally buried on the beach. So that's kind of the ending.
Okay, so lots of fun stuff there. Yes. And I want to see the movie. It's a movie, right?
Yes.
Okay. I totally want to see this movie. It's reminding me kind of Sexy Beast and, I don't know, tonally, if that's about right, which I love that movie. I don't quite yet know what Act Two is and who the main character is. Or are there two main characters? Is it the two people that are told to shoot each other? Are they the main characters?
They're the main characters.
And who are they?
Okay, so Eric is an older guy, 50s. He's a bit of a plotter. He just wants... This is the last heist for him. He's going to leave this gang. He's the last chance. He's finally going to make some decent money and go off and have a cruise. And Cole is much younger. He's the driver of the gang. And he's like the idiot savant. He's the clown. He lives in the moment. He fiddles and he can't sit still.
And do they like each other or not like each other?
They're kind of like a family. They love each other, but they don't like each other.
But they don't want to shoot each other.
They don't. They definitely don't want to shoot each other.
They're kind of making a choice that we're not going to do what these things say.
Yeah.
And we're not going to shoot each other.
But there is a moment where Cole, because he believes that he's got to do everything that Robbo tells him, is going to do this. But he's happy to be talked out of it.
Okay, so is it a dual protagonist then? They each have their own point of view on the thing?
There is, but in my head, Eric, the older guy, is going to go on a bigger journey.
Right, okay. And so what is his end of Act Two?
His end of Act Two is that it's become clear to him that he's not going to get anything out of this heist, that he's been living endlessly for the future to arrive to make him happy. He's always annoyed by Cole, who's living in the present permanently and making fun out of the world as he lives. All his dreams are just collapsed in front of him. He's not going to get anything out of this heist.
So what's interesting about that, again, I'm not saying you didn't do any of these things. We're just digging around. Those are all things that he's realizing that happened to him versus what he created himself. So what is his self-responsibility at the end of Act Two? Is it transformative? Like, I have chosen a life, or why, maybe ask why he has to live in the future? What is so scary to him about living in the present, right? So, because again, I'm not saying that's not an interesting idea, but I don't feel anything yet when you say it. When people say their end of Act Twos, I want to feel it in my body, not just think it in my head. So I like the idea of I've been living in the future because I don't want to live in the present because why doesn't he want to live in the present?
What's revealed at the end of Act Two is because he keeps talking about he's going to go on this cruise with his wife, Joni, and what's revealed is his wife actually left him 2 years ago. She's not there anymore.
So he's living kind of a fantasy.
Correct.
And why did she leave him?
That's a good question. I don't know.
But that's the question. Mm-hmm. Do you see how that might be the question of the rudder? Because, again, being left is something that happens to you. Do you hear the reaction? What does he believe, whether it's right or wrong, by the way, of why she left him? And it could just be this whole movie has been about him avoiding admitting what is the truth of why she left him. Like I think of Officer and a Gentleman, where he is pushing him and pushing him and pushing him and pushing him until finally, at the end of Act Two, he starts screaming, "I got no place to go." And this thing that's been sitting under this amazing character, what an amazing character that character is, because he's such an asshole and he's such a scumbag to start, because that's his survival instinct, until finally this guy breaks him, and as soon as he can say, "Because I got no place to go," now you can be a gentleman. Now you can be an officer, right? So that break of why she left him, what he believes about himself, which maybe through learning with this experience with this other kid, he's realizing isn't true, or it is true, and he has been creating this whole movie because he won't just love that part of himself or admit that part of himself, or that he made a mistake and it's okay. I mean, there's a million reasons of, you know, I got no place to go. Why? Because you got nobody in your life. You have created that.
Yeah.
Right? So there's, to find that would starts to become for me like the rudder of a rewrite, right? Like once you start digging that up, and something that will make you feel vulnerable, I can start to say, okay, well then in the plot, where does he start to learn the opposite, or how does, anyway, so go ahead, Laurie.
Is there an actor you have in mind to play him? Like an actor that really speaks to you, whether he's alive or dead or old or young?
There is actually, it's my brother.
Okay.
Who is an actor. But imagine, imagine Russell Crowe, if you like.
So. Okay. Russell Crowe, what era of Russell Crowe are we talking about?
He hasn't done any much good for a while,
like,
has he?
Like, is it Gladiator Russell Crowe?
No,
or is
he,
it Les Mis Russell Crowe?
It's more contemporary Russell Crowe.
Okay.
So Eric is sort of overweight, 55.
Yeah, a little gone to
unhappy,
pot.
A bit.
Okay.
Yeah,
but he's got this physical, past his prime kind of thing. Sorry, Russell Crowe, if you're listening. But, you know, that sort of energy, he's not listening, it's okay. That sort of energy, okay, so that helps me sort of understand that there's, like, this strength and this, like,
the other
thing behind, like, he's got a shield around him.
Yeah.
And Russell Crowe's characters, and I say this with admiration, they're highly skilled, and they are a little bit know-it-alls, a little bit, so that there's something to break down. There's something to break down that know-it-allness that, again, I'm not saying you're not doing that in your script, but there is a shield, there's a mask to get through. And then something that, just an exercise you can do when you pick the character is, you can chart Russell Crowe as an actor. He's probably traveling on the same structure, character transformation, like structure is just character transformation. He is probably just traveling on that. Midpoints generally don't line up, I think, but you can look at 3-5 Russell Crowe movies where he is leading. Supporting doesn't work as well. And how do we meet him? Who is he? What does he believe about himself? What does he believe about the world? What are his skills, flaws? Just look at all that in Act One. And then where is he, you know, what is the inciting incident? Where is he as a character at the end of Act One? What is his new goal and plan at the end of start of Act Two? What is the midpoint? Generally, they don't line up. What is his end of Act Two as a character? Because this is all the character points where their giant shifts are happening. And then what does he do in the climax? And you'll start to see a pattern emerge. And this is just a writing exercise.
Yeah.
And then you take that pattern and you stick it on your script. And you're like, oh my God, I'm totally not doing that. And it just starts to show you the places that you're kind of skating by, or you're not pushing him hard enough. Angelina Jolie has different patterns when she's in a big studio movie or when she's in an indie film. When she's in a big studio movie, she is the most powerful person and she has to learn humility. And when she's in an indie film, she's a humble person
Gia.
Who's not claiming her power
yeah.
and she has to claim her power. And they're completely reversed. But she's kind of exploring the same thing,
yeah.
but from opposite sides.
Nicole right? Kidman has this throughout her career. You can track her movies, like she's the victim, she's saved, and then now she's like, a badass powerhouse right at the beginning. So, but like it's her career in the movie shift that you can see happening. It's real. I love her thing. It's
just
really
an exercise
cool.
to do to find that end of Act Two. The most important thing is that end of Act Two emotionally resonates with you.
Yeah.
But to help you find it, sometimes looking at those characters can help you get into a sandbox at least of what theme that they seem to be doing over and over.
Are there any risks writing with a specific actor in mind?
Some writers absolutely say don't do it, and some writers say they do. It just is such a personal thing. I like to have an actor But some people really, really don't.
I don't start with an actor because I feel it's distracting when I'm writing. But then once I've written it, I'm like, oh, who would be great for this? For a pitch, you have to be able to show comps like it's Kristen Milioti or it, you know, it just tells a different tone. But I think there's danger in only writing for that specific actor because then another actor will read it and be like, I can't.
It's more a tool if you want to. Look, it's like a frame to put on it. So it's just a tool in your toolbox. I'm not at all saying create from that. I'm saying once you've got your script and you've done a couple of drafts, and if you're stuck, this is a way to maybe see where you're stuck.
So one thing I want to ask about, and you don't have to answer this, is if you're writing this for your brother to be in, that's the piece that I'm like, why? Why is this about your brother? Why is your brother this character? Like, those are all the whys I have. In terms of maybe
the
love isn't.
Are you the future guy or the present guy in your brother team?
Oh, no, I think my biggest fear in life is turning into Eric, this character, who doesn't live in the moment, because Cole is this childlike character who lives in the moment, who never thinks about what's going to be the consequences of anything, and we laugh at him, but he's a delight to be with. But Eric is so annoyed by him.
But what's so amazing and what I love about what you're exploring is there is a gray zone, because there is also a problem to only living in the moment. There is those people, like my son, they tend to need to be taken care of, right? Because they're fine, always, you know, that isn't black and white, right? And it's just that he's out of balance, right? And probably he'll still be who he is, right? But I do think there's something emotional underneath why you don't want to live in the present. That and why she left him, that is where that's the real thing you're exploring, and I don't know what that is, because we have to know why she left him, and be careful, because you might say, well, because he's always at work. Okay, why is he always at work? You have to keep asking why until you start to feel that shudder coming up, right?
Great.
But I love a heist movie, and I love what was the movie with Ryan Reynolds and where it was all like the big reversals at the end, like all the trickery. What was that movie? It had red in the title. You know, it's the movie red. With the thing. Yeah, the movie with the thing with the guy. Anyway, I love a heist movie.
Is it Red Notice?
Red Notice, that's the one. Oh my God, I've had half a cup of coffee, okay? You know, where there's, oh, it's gonna be this is the answer, and then there's this big twist that sort of changes everything you've seen up till that point. And I feel like that's what you're doing, right? And that's so fun.
And I'm really looking for, and I love Fat Boy being the thin girl in the dunes with his rifle. Love
yes,
it.
Yes.
Love it. You're breaking archetypes and combining archetypes, which I love it. You know, I just think of Sexy Beast, which I'm pretty sure is Sexy Beast, right? Where he's in his pool at the beginning, and then that giant rock comes down, and it's just such a wonderful metaphor for what's coming to the sky. So it's awesome. Yeah. And so can't wait to see it.
Great job. Thank you.
Thank you very much.